Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
I'm Harriet Gilbert. Welcome to a special anniversary World Book Club. 30 years since the publication of Jeanette Winterson's novel Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit. It's a chance to hear again her talking about the book with us 3 years ago. The darkly funny story of a child's battle to escape the clutches of her mother's extreme and fiercely eccentric religion. The novel thrust the then unknown Jeanette into the limelight. It won a Whitbread Award, became a TV drama, even became a set book in schools, and most of all, translated into 17 languages, it acquired a devoted worldwide readership. Since then, Jeanette's novels, including The Passion and most recently The Daylight Gate, have continued to win awards in Britain, France, Italy, a Commonwealth Writers' Prize, and in 2006 Jeanette was honoured with an OBE. She's also written a much-admired memoir called Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal, which focuses on her childhood as the adopted only daughter of a quiet man and a tornado of a woman, a religious convert determined that whatever it takes, she'll turn Jeanette into a missionary. Although the memoir flashes with humour, that whatever it takes can make for painful reading, as the child is beaten, exorcised, locked out of the house overnight, not because she straightforwardly rejects her mother's religion, but because she insists on finding her own path, spiritually, intellectually and sexually. Well, that's the recent memoir, but 30 years ago in Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, Jeanette told a lighter, semi-fictionalised version of her story. And here, prior to answering questions about it from an invited World Book Club audience and listeners around the world, she reads the novel's opening.
Like most people, I lived for a long time with my mother and father. My father liked to watch the wrestling. My mother liked to wrestle. It didn't matter what. She was in the white corner, and that was that. She hung out the largest sheets on the windiest days. She wanted the Mormons to knock on the door. At election time in a Labour mill town, she put a picture of the Conservative candidate in the window. She had never heard of mixed feelings. There were friends and there were enemies. And enemies were the devil, in his many forms, next door, sex, in its many forms, slugs. And friends were God, Our Dog, Auntie Madge, the novels of Charlotte Bronte, slug pellets. And me, at first. I had been brought in to join her in a tag match against the rest of the world. She had a mysterious attitude towards the begetting of children. It wasn't that she couldn't do it, more that she didn't want to do it, and she was very bitter about the Virgin Mary getting there first. So she did the next best thing and arranged for a foundling. That was me. I cannot recall a time when I didn't know that I was special. We had no wise men because she didn't believe there were any wise men, but we had sheep. And one of my earliest memories is me sitting on a sheep at Easter while she told me the story of the sacrificial lamb. We had it on Sundays with potato. And Sunday was the Lord's Day, the most vigorous day of the whole week. And we had a radiogram at home with an imposing mahogany front and a fat Bakelite knob that you twiddled for the stations. And usually we listened to the light programme. But on Sundays, always the world service, so that my mother could record the progress of our missionaries.
Jeanette Winterson, thank you. And here you are on the world service. And our first question about oranges are not the only fruit comes from Ivory Coast, from Côte d'Ivoire, from someone who I suspect isn't a missionary. He's called Acre Guy Roland. And he asks this: Hello, Jeanette, I'd like to ask, what motivated you to write Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit?
I had to. From the very beginning with Mrs. Winterson, I had to learn to set my story against hers because she was a woman of dark extravagant narratives, but she always knew how to tell a story. You know, when there were mice running about in our kitchen and I said, what are they? She said they were ectoplasm. So, you know, the children had mice, I had ectoplasm. There was never a straightforward answer, but there was always a narrative. And also, this was a woman who read the Bible standing up to me and my dad every day, starting at the beginning at Genesis and working her way right through to the book of Revelation, which is her favourite bit, you know, when the devil gets cast into the pit and everything gets blown up. And then she'd give us 2 weeks off to think about things and we'd start again. So, although books were forbidden in our house, you know, I was living inside these connecting narratives, the narrative of the Bible, the story of creation, the story of the apocalypse, and all the narratives of Mrs. Winterson. So given that life is part fiction and part fact, I felt that the best way for me to protect myself, to defend myself, to invent myself, was to tell my own story.
I'm Janet Guyford from Essex. My question relates really to what you were just saying, which was when you were going through all these experiences as a child, did you already think then you must write a book about it one day, or did that idea come to you later on?
Well, I'm not sure I would make that distinction. In a way, I was my own narrative. You see, I've always been able to read myself as a story, and that's one of the things that helped me through. Because, you know, in all those fairy stories, it's always the stupid third son, isn't it? The little guy that's overlooked, who finally finds the treasure and kills the dragon or wins the princess. And I thought, oh, that's me. So that made me optimistic. And also, when I read the Bible stories, they didn't seem remote to me. They seemed very personal. They seemed to be about me. So I never thought of myself as a child living in a crummy place with, you know, a few social problems and a crazy mother. You know, I thought of myself as a child who had stories and who learned to tell stories. You know, when I was locked in the coal hole, I used to tell myself stories when she locked me out at night. So for me, reading myself in that way, as a fiction as well as a fact, was what gave me the courage both to go forward and to think, well, I can change the ending, because if it's your story, you can. You're not stuck. You change it.
Hi, I'm Janu from Hampshire. First of all, thank you for a lovely book. I really loved reading it. And in particular, I love the character of Jeanette. And one of the reasons she was so wonderful to read was because of her humour, which made her very, very vivid to me. And given that it is a very profoundly sad book in some ways, what was it about the humour? Was the humour accidental, or did you purposefully make it funny in order for us to get through it?
Jeanette, before you answer that, in fact, we've had a question that is very similar to that, but takes it on a bit, which was tweeted to the World Book Club by somebody calling herself Twangy Pearl, the Elastic Girl.
Okay.
Don't go there. Anyway, her question, which indeed is similar to yours, is how much does Jeanette use the tool of elliptical humour in Oranges to sugarcoat the harshness of the pain she experienced?
Well, nothing I do is accidental. And, you know, you use all sorts of devices to tell your story. You have to. And any artlessness is always artful in some way. You know, it's a construction. Of course it is. You know, this is a constructed narrative. It's not some sort of spontaneous outpouring. You know, that's always been a risky version of how people write. I blame the romantics. But, you know, I do come from the north, and northern people have a good sense of humour. And our town, you know, it was rough. It was a grimy, rough and tumble way to be brought up. But everybody was both able to tell a story. You know, they had really fantastic use of language, wide vocabulary. And they were always making jokes. And I think that's come across. That's always been there in my work. And I'm sure that's because of what I heard, you know, because it was an oral tradition, not a literary tradition where I grew up. And words, you know, they begin in the mouth before they hit the page. And they start in our ears, you know, before anything else happens. And so that's the language that I heard, the language of the Bible, the language of Mrs. Winterson. And this sort of wild dialect around me, which always had humour shot through it, and I brought that, I think, ever since into my work.
I've only ever heard you refer to your adoptive mother as Mrs. Winterson. When did you start calling her that, rather than mum or whatever?
Well, I did call her mum when I was growing up, but, you know, it has certain connotations, doesn't it, the mum or mother, and somehow they never really applied to Mrs. Winterson. So, and she always called herself Mrs. Winterson, and her friends, such as she had called her, that they'd knock on the door and they wouldn't. Sometimes they'd say, "Is your mother in?" But they'd say, "You know, we've come to see Mrs. Winterson." And that's how she addressed it. She was very formal and she was that kind of character. It suits her in a way. And also because I guess I wanted to objectify the relationship somewhat. She had to be a character as well as a person.
Question now, Jeanette, from Heather Lovegrove, who's a British listener to the BBC World Book Club. And she emailed this: "Part of my enjoyment of your novel came from a familiarity with the church background you describe, and particularly the use of the Old Testament and the redemption hymnal as part of the vocabulary of everyday life. Did you consider the fact that the majority of readers would not be familiar with these references? For example, does it matter if the significance of the naming of the chapters after the books of the Old Testament is not picked up on?"
I think everyone has a copy of the Redemption Hymnal at home.
Oh, no, they don't.
Well, I helpfully put in some of the hymns. You probably know, "Yield not to temptation, for yielding is sin. Each victory will help you, some other to win. Fight manfully onward, dark passions subdue. Look ever to Jesus, he will carry you through." I mean, you could make the tune up yourselves, couldn't you? I mean, it's all that rumpity-tumpity-tum stuff, which goes so well in the evangelical churches. So I think as long as the thing is described, I think all of us have a sense of what that is like. And in any case, the evangelical movement, the Pentecostal church, is the fastest growing religious movement in the world. So if they didn't know it before, I think they know it now.
A question now from Alaska. It's from Julie Roger, and she's actually on the telephone now to ask it, I think. Julie, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Julie, over to you.
Thank you. Hello, Jeanette.
Hello.
I read Oranges this summer while in the midst of finishing the first draft of an autobiographical play. My script deals with breaking from a strict Catholic upbringing in favor for a spiritual life that celebrates rather than demonizes sexual and creative expression.
Good idea.
Yeah. Oranges and your newest book, Why Be Happy, have given me such great hope and courage towards the task of completing this story that I too know I must tell. I wonder, however, if you faced fears during the writing and publishing of Oranges with regards to how family members or your relationship to them might be adversely affected by your book. And if so, how did you manage to overcome these fears?
Well, I think they had already adversely affected their relations with me. I think we were already in a dysfunctional familial situation long before Oranges was written. I think that's what comes of shutting your child in the coal hole, amongst other things, or arranging the exorcism. So I thought it was fair enough, although Mrs. Winterson did say when Oranges was published, she said, "It's the first time I've had to order a book in a false name." So she was her usual spirited self. And there was always that combat between us. I've been more careful in the memoir. I mean, I wouldn't have written that before both my parents were dead, which they were. And I was also very careful not to name other people who I thought might be hurt by any of that. But, you know, you have to decide for yourself because there's no hard and fast rule. And sometimes things have to be said which will hurt other people. But, you know, unhappy families are conspiracies of silence. And the one who breaks the silence is never forgiven.
Julie, I'm assuming that you are facing those kinds of worries about how your family is going to react to what you're writing. Is what Jeanette says helpful to you?
Yes, very much so. And I know that I'm facing it and I need to face it and move through it. And that come what may come, that's my job at the moment.
I can't remember who said it, or indeed the precise words, but somebody did say that one of the greatest tragedies in life is having a writer in the family. And I think that's the way it goes. Anyway, Julie, thank you very much for calling the programme.
Thank you so much.
We have an email now from Claire Hyatt Harris in Bristol in the west of England. And I'm not sure I understand the question, but Jeanette, you will. Jeanette, could I ask you your thoughts on your own experience as a writer in terms of Virginia Woolf's essay, A Room of One's Own? Were you held back as a writer by your lack of private space? In Oranges, you didn't even have a key to a house, your mother policed your bedroom, and sleeping in a car appears to be your first private space. How did you overcome this as a writer?
I made money. Virginia Woolf says, of course, in the 1929 essay, A Room of One's Own, that you need £500 a year as well as a room of one's own. And I realised quite early on that I was going to have to make my own money. It's essential if you're a woman anyway. You must not be dependent. You must have something in your purse, preferably that you have earned yourself. It doesn't need to be a lot, but it needs to be enough so that you can hold your head up and not be beholden to everybody else, especially if you want to do your own work. I quite like living in the mini. I didn't feel that in any way that it was some sort of punishment or deprivation. I always used to read balancing the book on the steering wheel, and then I'd get out and walk round to the other side and eat on the passenger side, and that made me feel like I had two doors, you know, and a bit of a walk. It was spacious, and I slept in the back, and I thought, it's fortunate that I'm small. And I kept my books in the boot because Mrs. Winterson destroyed my books. So it seemed to me that it was actually a step forward from living in 200 Water Street. You know, and if you want to do creative work, then you can't worry too much about the comforts of life. You must simply do the work and do your best and hope that somehow you can pay the bills and get on with it. But above all, it's the spirit that matters. And one good thing about growing up so poor is that material things have really never mattered to me. Look, I've done very well now. It's nice for me. I've got a couple of houses. I don't have to sleep in the car. But that is not important. What's important is being able to find the space to do the work.
I wonder if contained within Claire's question as well is an idea not just of physical space, you know, a few square metres to sit in and work, but space within your head. Because the interesting thing about the mother you describe in the novel is that she's not negligent. Far from it. She's in young Jeanette's head almost the whole time. Mm. I mean, she's a very, very overpowering, focused presence. And that might also, I suppose, have made it very difficult for you to, as you say, tell your own story about what was going on.
Yes, it might have done, but it didn't. It worked in the opposite direction because she was her own paid-up member of the Secret Service, and we were always under surveillance in our house, even though it was tiny. She, you know, she was always appearing with a flashlight in the dead of night, looking for who knows what. And after she destroyed the books, I know I had a collection of books which I used to hide under my bed. And if anybody who's got a single bed and a collection of paperbacks will know that you can get 74 per layer under the mattress. But of course, she discovered this, and one of the things she did was to destroy them and burn them. And that was a terrible moment. You know, this auto de fe in the backyard in this crummy terraced house in Accrington, and which I will never forget. But then I realised after that that anything that was outside me could be destroyed, and that's when I started learning, memorising texts. Because I thought, if it's inside me, she can't get at it. No matter how much she goes about with her flashlight, if it's in me, it's invisible and it belongs to me. And I learned early that only what's inside you cannot be taken away.
This question comes from Sterling in Virginia in the USA. It's from Daniel Rothman, and he posted it. Well, actually, what he's posted is a kind of mini essay. He posted it on our Facebook page. I will not read the whole of it. It would take the whole programme. But this is a crucial paragraph. In terms of content, I found the book a very affecting tale of the struggle of a young lady confronting her sexuality, the acute mismatch between her discovered homosexuality and the closed-minded religiosity of her mother and her church community. Ms. Winterson draws a contrast between the main character's assertion of her feelings and her strength and the conformity of the girl who is her first lover. But I found the main character somewhat unrealistically self-assured. Much of the self-doubt and soul-searching that I've known in folks coming to their own acceptance and embrace of their homosexuality is externalised onto the first lover, isn't it?
I think that depends on who you are. It doesn't have to be that way, no. And that wasn't really what I was thinking about. I was never thinking about sexuality like that. I was thinking about love, which is different. It never occurred to me to put a label on myself. And indeed, I've spent all of my adult life trying to rip them off, both me and the work I do. You know, we're always sticking labels on things because anything that's free makes us nervous. So if we put a label on it, we limit it and then we feel comfortable. We don't have to think about that anymore. So what I was interested in was the fact that I had fallen in love and that the love I was feeling was being denied or denigrated. And that's what I was fighting for. I didn't feel it was an issue of sexuality. I thought it was something that seems to me far broader and far bigger and affects all of us, whatever our sexual preferences or desires. And both of those things change, I think, by the way, over a lifetime. I have absolutely no interest in this homosexual gene or whatever they think they've discovered now. You know, who you love is who you love. The rapper is completely irrelevant and very boring. The most boring thing you know about somebody is the gender of the person they're sleeping with. So for me, it was about love, which also keyed into self-worth and self-discovery, because we know ourselves through those people that we love. It's a way of getting rid of our own selfishness, our own self-absorbedness, and suddenly realising that we exist in relation to the other. And that's the most wonderful thing that happens in life, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think we can clap for that.
Hello, my name is Kirsten Müller. I'm from Berlin. I'm wondering just what you were saying now, sticking labels on things, and you were saying earlier how you were discovering yourself with language or defining yourself with language. I'm wondering, because language is so restricted. I went to this event, this panel discussion of gay, lesbian, all these different things that there are, and I found that a really big problem that they have, or even all minorities have, is finding a term that they can use in their struggle. So language is kind of restricted like that. And when it comes to fighting for your rights, you need some sort of a label to administer your cause. I'm wondering if you would have any sort of idea how to resolve this problem.
So having said that you don't approve of labels, can you come up with one that gay men, gay women, bisexual people, transgendered people can use as an umbrella term in the campaign?
Yes, human beings.
Yeah, I know. I mean, obviously, it is a sort of a vicious circle, I guess, because, I mean, if they want to administer their cause, or even any minorities, they need to exactly name the difference.
I'm not sure we do need to be naming difference, you know. I think we need to learn how to love and to accept each other, and that we are all, we're all the same. You know, we're made in the same way. Everybody wants to love. And, the object of your love is really not the point. I think, you know, love is so difficult and relationships are so hard anyway. It seems to me that what we need to be able to do, you know, is to concentrate on how to develop our humanity, to become better at being human altogether, rather than, and there are civil rights issues, of course there are, but that's about equality, that whoever we love and whatever gender we are, you know, we should be equal under the law and in the eyes of one another. And that's a big broad fight that I'd like to think everybody was involved in, you know, straight, gay, black, white, male, female. You know, we should want a planet where we are equal. Equal in love, equal in work, you know, equal in our lives. And that's what interests me more than anything. And I saw a great cartoon in The New Yorker last week, and it was two men reading, and one says to the other, "Gay marriage? Haven't gay people suffered enough already?" I love that.
Okay, I think time now for another reading from Orange Is Not the Only Fruit. I need to explain that the narrative of Jeanette's trying to find her way through this family situation, through her life and out somewhere the other side, is interrupted every so often by fragments of dreams, of fairy tales, of chivalric romance. And Jeanette, would you read for us? This is a bit concerning a heroic young woman called Winnet. Is that how you pronounce that?
Yeah, I think it is, because in the book she's called Winnet E. Stonejar, which is an anagram of Jeanette Winterson.
I hadn't realised. Stupid me. Anyway, here Winnet is preparing to leave home and set out on a journey. Yeah.
Winnet tried to imagine what the city might be like. Some of her village said it was made of crystal. Others, that it had been spun from a web. Some called it a nonsense, and told her she'd still be unhappy, even if she managed to find it. But she thought how everybody there must be strong and healthy, and she thought of their compassion and wisdom. In a place where truth mattered, no one would betray her. And so her courage grew, and with it her determination. She found a map rolled up round a broom handle, and the map showed the forest and the edges of the forest where the towns began. And she found the river, placid and shrunk, but growing to a huge mouth where she had once lived, And this river belted the sacred city and, splitting itself like a cut worm, flowed variously into the sea. Winnet had never sailed on the sea. She had known the sea only as it came to the shore, known it only in connection with the land. She was afraid of it, although she knew that the faithful have made miracles from coracles. The easiest way to the city was out to the sea, and then back up into the river again. The only other way was through the deepest forest, down a part of the river that looked like a tunnel. And the waters there were brackish. She could not hope to navigate them. They lost themselves in a thick tree dark that lasted long after the night. She must find a boat and sail in it. No guarantee of shore, only a conviction that what she wanted could exist if she dared to find it.
Jeanette Winston, thank you very much indeed for that.
My name is Cathy South, and I'm from Essex. And Jeanette, you've talked about telling stories, and so my question is, how did you decide on the structure of the book with the fantasy sections about Winnet that you've just read, about Percival, the knight, about the princess at the beginning? How did you decide to alternate these with the rest of the book, the realistic sections about Jeanette growing up?
I've never wanted to make a distinction between imagination and experience, and if I had to, I would always, I suppose, vote for the triumph of imagination over experience, because that seems to me to be where hope is. And also, in the truth about ourselves, we are made up as much of our dreams, our longings, as we are of our daily events, of our daily lives, of our CV world. And so when I was telling this, I wanted all of that to be in there, because one of the things fiction does is to tell the truth about how life is, life as a whole, not life in part. And social realism always seemed to me to be just a part of life. And I thought, no, you must have everything else in there, the inner world, and those pressures of dreams and of longings and of desires and of imagination. So all I knew is I wanted to get everything in together, all of a model. I'd never written a book before, so how would I know? So I just thought, well, I'll set off. And I thought the best thing to do is to just write my own Bible, which is what I did, and so start the chapter with Genesis and then go through. So I made myself a structure which was useful, and then I was able to stuff things in it and hang things on it, as far as I was concerned, all of the self was in play rather than a part of the self. So that was the aim.
Thank you.
Hello, Jeanette. It's Helen from Aylesbury. Given that your start in life was such a tremendous fertiliser for this creative spirit that's gone on to be very successful, how do you look back on your early life? Is it with bitterness, or do you reflect in a different way that, in fact, it was in some way an advantage, all those difficulties you faced?
I think it was an advantage. I mean, if you read the memoir, Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal, you'll find towards the end that I really talk about this, because I was forced to think about Winterson World in a different way and realise how much Mrs. Winterson had given to me and allowed to happen, which I hadn't really thought of before. I came to forgive her over that time, and also to recognise how she had made me. You know, when I met my biological mother, it's quite interesting, it wasn't this sudden rush of DNA thinking, here's my mother. I suddenly realised how much more Mrs. Winterson had been my mother, however difficult that was. And looking back on it, you know, I couldn't have had a better life for being me, could I? It was perfect, really. I mean, it was completely bonkers. It shouldn't have worked. I don't know where I should be now. Probably dead. But I'm not. I'm here with you. And, you know, that does seem to me to be the triumph of imagination over experience.
I'm Juno Cheadle from West Cork. I just wanted to know, growing up in such a controlling household, on one level it could stunt somebody's growth and make them quite childlike for the whole of their life. But do you think that it forced you to become an adult at a very young age because of such a controlling mother and less time to play and be a child?
I don't think it was like that. I had lots of time to play and be a child. Remember, this was the 1960s, so there wasn't global media. And television went off anyways. And the BBC just disappeared, didn't it, about 11 o'clock at night. And it didn't come on till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, we used to have that rather scary child and the test card, didn't we? Sitting there. So you had to live in your own world much more, which I think was an advantage, just to make your own games, make your own life. Mrs. Winston didn't interfere with that at all. And I had plenty of time to invent a world, and I needed to. So my childhood was intact. You know, it may have been eccentric, and it may seem to be abusive. But as far as I was concerned, I was quite happy. You know, weirdly, I was a happy child. I was not miserable, and I didn't think I was having an awful time. I just wanted to be able to get into the library, read the forbidden books, and make up stories. And as long as I could do that, everything was fine. And look, that's all I've done for the rest of my life.
Hello, my name is Rebecca. Would you say that the challenges faced by the young woman in Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit nearly 30 years ago are the same or different to now? And if so, what are the differences, or have things moved on? To what extent?
For me or for children?
Well, for a young lesbian girl growing up. The challenges that were posed.
Well, you're very sure that I was sure of my sexuality, and we're coming back to something here which is interesting. Is anybody ever sure? I mean, I've had 7 boyfriends. That just seemed to me significant. But, you know, we're back to these determining definitions, which I think are so unhelpful. And one of the things that worries me about kids growing up now, and given the awareness of everybody, which is supposed to be a good thing about sexuality, is that kids are mercilessly bullied in school just when they want to experiment. They shouldn't have to put a label on themselves. You know, when you're 15 or 16, the last thing you need to be wondering is, am I gay? Am I straight? You know, you don't need to ask yourself that question. And we force it on kids just as we force it on ourselves later. So I do feel quite strongly about that. We need more freedom in our life, not less. And we need to be able to feel that we can love where we will without suddenly having to have endless self-examination classes about what this says about our entire nature. I mean, sometimes you just want to go to bed with somebody. It doesn't mean you want to spend the rest of your life with them or change your whole sexual orientation. You know, things happen on trains.
You old subversive radical, you, Jeanette. We've got a question now from Brockville, Ontario in Canada. It's from Alan Gordon, and he's on the telephone to ask it. Alan, hi.
Hi. Good afternoon, Jeanette.
Hello.
My name is Alan Gordon, and I'm calling from Brockville here in Canada. I must admit I was very excited when I finished your book. I thought to myself that young people in Britain and here in Canada should be encouraged to read your novel for the wisdom and the insights attached to Jeanette's development from, I guess it's the age of 7, is it, to young adulthood.
Yes.
I find your writing lively, humorous, and certainly thought-provoking. My question focuses on Chapter 5, the chapter titled Deuteronomy. It's only 3 pages long. What prompted you to abandon the story's narrative at that point, only to resume the story in the next chapter?
Because it should be explained that the chapter Deuteronomy is kind of a riff on memory and history and stories, that kind of thing. There is no narrative in it. It's just thoughts.
Yes, it begins with time is a great deadener. Because I was always outraged by that old cliche about time being a great healer, which seems to me to be such a monstrous load of tosh. And in fact, people tend to just to get numb or to forget. You know, if you just leave it to time, very little happens. You know, we need to be active, not passive, not just sit there watching the clock hands go round. But, you know, can you remember why you did something 27 years ago? At that point, naturally enough, because Deuteronomy in the Bible, it's called the last book of the law. It's the last book of Moses. And it is a break, actually, at that point. And of course, I was going Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, so I got to Deuteronomy. So I kind of had to do something else according to my self-imposed structure. And that's what I did. And I wanted a breathing space. And anyway, I like everything to be short because I'm easily bored.
Thank you.
Alan, can I just ask you, did it bring you up short? Did you enjoy it? I mean, is your question prompted by having thought, hey, that was a really good idea, or having thought, why on earth did she mess with the book like that?
Yeah, if you look at other novels, I mean, it does represent a major hiatus in the story, and it's just that prompted my question. Frankly, I enjoyed the whole book, and if anything, and I'm quite old now, it's taught me something about tolerance, and I hope that a lot of people will know this.
Alan Gordon, thank you very much indeed for that. Jeanette, I've got a question for you now, which comes from Perth in Western Australia. It's from Rashmi Veach. And she didn't like the breaks in the novel. She writes, I find it most frustrating that the narrative goes along quite smoothly and then suddenly jumps, leaving me with unanswered questions. For me, a good book tells a good story and keeps the reader totally bound. Weren't you afraid of losing readers by jumping on ahead the way you do?
No.
Is that it?
Yes.
Rashmi, that's the answer to your question. It's brief, it's to the point. You're listening to the World Book Club from the BBC World Service, where our guest today is the British author Jeanette Winterson, talking about her award-winning coming-of-age novel, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit. Jeanette, now I think time for a third reading. I mean, we've already heard about the fictional Jeanette's first lover, the first child with whom she falls in love. She's called Melanie. And if you could just read the point in the novel, this is where Jeanette and her first love, Melanie, move from friendship into loverdom.
When I reached Melanie's house, it was getting dark. I had to cut through the churchyard to get there, and sometimes I'd steal her a bunch of flowers from the new graves. She was always pleased, but then I never told her where the flowers came from. She asked me if I wanted to stay overnight because her mum was away and she didn't like being in the house on her own. I said I'd ring a neighbour and after much trouble finally got an agreement from my mother, who had to be fetched from her lettuces. Melanie and I read the Bible as usual and then we told each other how glad we were that the Lord had brought us together. And she stroked my head for a long time and then we hugged and it felt like drowning. And then I was frightened, but I couldn't stop. There was something crawling in my belly. I had an octopus inside me. And it was evening, and it was morning. Another day. And after that, we did everything together, and I stayed with her as often as I could. And my mother seemed relieved that I was seeing less of Graham. And for a while, she made no mention of the amount of time I spent with Melanie. Do you think this is unnatural passion? I asked Melanie once. Doesn't feel like it. According to Pastor Finch, that would be awful. She must be right, I thought.
Jeanette Winston, thank you very much. A question for you now about Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit from an Iraqi-born Canadian listener to the programme, who writes, she's Suad Sharabani, and she writes, when Melanie and Jeanette meet years later, Melanie says nothing happened between us. Something could have, but it did not. Do you think the two of them have different versions of history because Melanie's moved on and Jeanette is frozen in time?
I think those situations where you encounter a first lover sometime later are always awkward, aren't they? And you don't know whether you just want to punch them or kiss them. It's always a dilemma. But I think in the Oranges story, it's Jeanette who's prepared to change her life and indeed to take a few risks. And it's Melanie who, for all sorts of reasons, understandable but annoying, can't do any of that and retreats to safety. You know how it is, all of us, when enormous things happen in our lives, you arrive at the borders of common sense and you have to decide whether to turn back to what's safe and what's known or whether to cross over where nothing is safe and nothing is known. And in the story, the Jeanette character crosses over and the Melanie character turns back.
Jeanette Winston, thank you.
Hi, I'm Laura. I just wondered if, because I actually studied the passion at university, and I know that now oranges are not the only fruit is studied sometimes at A-level, how it feels knowing that your books are not only read but studied in that way.
Yes, as I get older, of course, more books get on the list, which is nerve-wracking. But I just hope it makes people enjoy reading and enjoy the power of literature and language rather than put them off. And I do get the idea and the impression from schools and from teachers, so I do a lot of work in schools, that it's working and that people get excited by these texts. And that's what I want, because in the end, this is a conversation and it's a continuum. You know, I read books for the same reason that you read books. We're all in it together. In a way, the fact that I write them doesn't make much difference. You know, we're all readers and that's the pleasure of it. And what I want to pass on to people is the great joy of reading and the power of it and how reading gives you back the language that you need to describe your own life. And if we can do that for kids, then that's a great thing.
Daniel from Hampshire again. What I wanted to ask was, in the book, for me, although religion, obviously, there is a negative to religion because it becomes a box for Jeanette, and she does suffer from it. But I wonder if she's empowered by it as well, because she obviously does sermons and things, and the book structure is following the book. A biblical one. So I was wondering, is it also empowering for the character and indeed for you? Because does it give you a sense of how to tell stories and tell them well?
Well, as a young woman growing up in the 60s and 70s, and certainly in my experience pre-feminism, I didn't even know about feminism until I went to Oxford. I'd never heard of it in the late 70s, which is anyway when the feminist movement was hitting in Britain. So for me as a woman then, the church did give me both a powerful role because I was allowed to stand up and speak. I wasn't silenced. And naturally enough, therefore, it gave me confidence. And also, I was really good at saving souls. And I've gone on saving souls. You know, I am a missionary. Mrs. Winterson got what she wanted. Just that it's a power of language that I'm interested in. I mean, it's a different kind of word, but it still has a capital W for me. So, yes, and I think that was really helpful to me growing up as a woman and also as a working class woman, and not to be afraid of language, but to feel that language belonged to me and that I could speak confidently and in public and expect there to be results. You know, I didn't need to have a sort of public school boys' education to get that. You know, I had the platform early on, and I think that was enormously helpful. And also when I got to Oxford, where everything about me was wrong, I still had that behind me. So I didn't suddenly fall into a jelly and think everybody here has been better educated and, you know, has parents and has money and you know, and has that sort of confidence that you get. You know, at least I had that. So, yes, and that was definitely from religion.
Question now, Jeanette, which came from a British listener to the BBC World Service. He posted this on Facebook. His name's Edward Quine, and he asked, could Jeanette Winterson imagine writing a book so clearly autobiographical about any other time in her life? And if not, why not?
I don't see it like that. I think that life is this mixture of part fact and part fiction, and that you, as a writer, you are always writing from this collision of imagination and experience, so that often things that have happened to you, of course, are reinvented and reworked in a way in all of your fiction. It cannot be otherwise. You know, we write from who we are. The objectivity is a myth. It's a male myth. You don't stand outside of yourself. You know, there is no Archimedean point where you can look down loftily on all you survey. You are in it, you know. Thank God quantum theory has made that clear to everybody, that there is no such thing as observer and observed. The thing is always, it's a relationship. Everything in life is a relationship. It's a dynamic. It's a chemical reaction. So that's why I won't make that distinction. And of course, it was based on my life. I mean, most first novels are, but everything else has been too, because it is my life.
But it is true, though, that whereas you don't need to be that brilliant a cryptologist to decipher the autobiography of this novel.
No,
you may not always know what was invented and what wasn't, but you know this is your story, and you've always been very open about it. With other novels of yours, it hasn't been necessarily very clear that this was based directly on your life.
No, it's been worked differently, but that's all. But, you know, this story wouldn't matter. You know, it's only in print now, 27 years later. Why, you know, why we're here today? Because something in it, however, you know, eccentric and particular that story is, and let's face it, it's not most people's story. You know, it translates because the language works. Primarily, and because people are able to connect with the spirit of it. You know, in the end, we're not talking about autobiography, we're talking about authenticity. That's what people pick up on. Does the thing move you? Does the thing meet you? That's the place where we need to be in literature, in art. We need to be moved, we need to feel something. You know, it doesn't just happen in the head, it happens in the whole body. And that happens through the language that we use and from the way that we construct the story, whether it's personal or whether it's not.
Another question that came via our Facebook page. It's from Lorraine Martin, and she writes, I'm from Birmingham in the UK. I'd like to know what your writing routine is. Do you write every day, how long for, and where? Many thanks.
Well, I don't write every day because, and I'm here talking to you, but on the days that I do, which is most days, and when I'm not travelling or doing all the other stuff that now comes with being a writer, which is a lot. We've got a new role these days. Then yes, the first thing I do in the morning is go to work. However, I do have to cycle to work, even though work is only across the garden, because I have this mad idea that if I go in a round circle for 4 miles and come back, then I've started work. Even though I could just do it in 10 paces, but you know, it gives me pleasure, so why not? It's not hurting anybody. So yes, and I am very disciplined about that, and always have been. In fact, what I need to do is take more holidays. I was saying to my girlfriend, we've only had 4 days holiday in the last year. It's not okay. So I have to work less and be less disciplined.
Thanks, Jeanette. And a question now from Heather Louise Jenkins in Coventry. Heather asks this. Hello, I'd like to ask what made you decide to start writing children's literature, which indeed you have, and how the experience compares with writing for adults.
Yes, I've written 2 picture books for kids and 2 novels for children, and that's because I have 2 fabulous godchildren who I've been very involved with since they were born. I was present at the birth of both of them with the mother and father. I was the birthing partner, so the mother is my dearest friend. And they're now 16 and 13. It's great. And of course, as they were growing up, I thought, well, what can I do? Some godmothers can knit and some godmothers can tell stories. So I thought I'd better get on with it. And that was really the impetus behind it. An enormous pleasure there for me, too. I love writing those books. I think I'll do another kids' book quite soon. Just because I want to know what happens next. Because kids' books do have to be quite linear, and you have the and then and then and then, and you have to get to the end because that's what they need. You know, they don't want too much reflection. They wouldn't want a chapter called Deuteronomy. For instance. So, you know, I go in there in a different spirit and I just enjoy myself and I never worry about how it's going to turn out, just so long as it does.
My name is Jimmy Saleh from Nigeria. I'm a friend of the program. If for any reason, say, you didn't write Oranges when you did and you are faced with the responsibility of having to write it now, will it be the same in terms of characterization, plot, sequence, etc., do you think?
I wouldn't write Oranges now, no. I'd write Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal, which is a memoir that I've just written. But, you know, everything is bound in time. We live in linear time. We have no choice, although our imaginations escape it and live in total time, or perhaps we could call it even real time, where the clock and the calendar are not so important. But then when I look back on all the books that I've written, they just seem to me to be one continuous stretch of narrative, which every so often is cut off and has a cover wrap around it, and then it's sold as a book. But it's really everything I've created over 27 years, and I'm not able anymore to distinguish between those. I can arbitrarily at moments like this, but in my own mind, when I go back over it, bits of the novels all lie side by side in different orders completely. So we could take them all, throw them in a machine, repackage them, and call them something else.
Thank you.
It's a wonderful publishing idea.
Hi, I'm Matthew from London. I read that you started the quest for literature after reading Malory's Le Bord d'Enfer, and I wondered if that really inspired Oranges and Not the Only Street, or has it inspired any of your other works?
Malory's book being a collection of traditional tales of chivalry and knighthood.
Mm. Yes, it was one of the few books in our house. We only had six books in our house in Accrington, and mostly about the Bible. But there was this one stray from another life that Mrs. Winterson tried to keep hidden, which was Malory's Mort d'Arthur, which was is the Grail legend stories and the Round Table. It's wonderful. And, of course, I read that, and it was the right story for me because the Grail is always somewhere else. You always have to seek it. So it was both about the missingness of the missing, which I felt in my life, which I suppose was the lost mother, but it was also about, you know, the ultimate quest story, that you have to leave behind what you know in order to find what it is that you long for, and that has been the hallmark of my life.
Thank you very much. And a question now comes from Romania. It's from Ali, or Alina, to give her her full name, Tomi. And she writes this: I'm a huge Jeanette Winterson fan, and I'd like to ask her what three words might describe her life. Thank you for the opportunity.
Only three?
Yep.
All those words. I suppose they would be, the most important one would be love, and the second one would be language, and the third one would be luck.
Jeanette Winterson talking in 2011 about oranges are not the only fruit, whose 30th anniversary it is. Next month, World Book Club goes to Kiev in Ukraine, where Andrei Kurkov answers questions about his dark satirical novel Death and the Penguin, in which a hapless writer called Victor, living in a recently post-Soviet Ukraine of chaos and ever-threatening violence, finds himself drawn into a mystery from which neither he nor his pet penguin may be able to escape. Here's Andrei Kurkov himself reading from the novel's opening.
First, a stone landed a meter from Victor's foot. He glanced back. Two louts stood grinning. Victor made off at something approaching a racing walk and rounded the corner, telling himself the main thing was not to run. He paused outside his block, glancing up at the hanging clock. 9 p.m. Not a sound. No one about. He went in, now no longer afraid. As he turned on the kitchen light, it went off again. They had cut the power, just like that, and in the darkness he became aware of the unhurried footfalls of Misha the penguin. Misha had appeared chez Victor a year before, when the zoo was giving hungry animals away to anyone able to feed them. Victor had gone alone and returned with the king penguin. Abandoned by his girlfriend the week before, he had been feeling lonely. But Misha had brought his own kind of loneliness, and the result was now two complementary lonelinesses, creating an impression more of interdependence than of amity. Unearthing a candle, he lit it and stood it on the table in an empty mayonnaise pot. The poetic tiny light sent him to look in the semi-darkness for pen and paper. He sat down at the table with the paper between him and the candle, paper asking to be written on. Had he been a poet, rhyme would have raced across the white. But he wasn't. He was trapped in a rut between journalism and scraps of prose. Short stories were the best he could do. Very short. Too short to make a living from, even if he got paid for them. A shot rang out. Darting to the window, Victor pressed his face to the glass. Nothing. He returned to his paper. Already he had thought up a story around that shot. A single side was all it took, no more, no less. And as his latest short story drew to its tragic close, the power came back on and the ceiling bulb blazed. Blowing out the candle, he fetched Goli from the freezer for Misha's bowl.
More about Misha and Victor next month when World Book Club travels to Ukraine to meet Andrei Kurkov. From producer Karen Holden and me, Harriet Gilbert, good listening.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.